Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Substation podcast. My name is Emma Burns.
And my name is Tom Edwards.
And today we're going to dive into a really hot topic in electricity market design, which is the question about locational marginal pricing. And we've spoken about this a few times on the podcast, and I think today we really wanted to see if we could list out what we think are all the alternatives to it, because it's gotten a lot of airtime. So this is all in response to a current program for market reform that's ongoing in Britain. So the government kicked this off last year, and one of the key questions in it was whether or not we should have locational marginal pricing in Britain. So Tom, what is locational marginal pricing?
Locational marginal pricing is where you combine the operational dispatch of power stations with the optimal dispatch across the network, taking into account thermal and voltage constraints. So, for example, where you might have two nodes on a system. Let's call one of them, say for argument's sake, Scotland, and the other one England. In between them, there's only this limited amount of power that you can dispatch. In a national market, you would dispatch all of those generators, and the price would be the same on both sides of the boundary, even if you couldn't dispatch them, and you'd sort out the problem afterwards. In a locational marginal price, before we even got to real time, the actual market trading would take into account that power couldn't flow from Scotland to England, and therefore you'd look at what the marginal pricing was in each of those zones, and let's say because Scotland has lots of low marginal cost generators, the price would clear very, very low. That would disincentivize people to generate in Scotland, and the price in England would clear much higher, incentivizing generation in England, and therefore there would be no need for corrective action afterwards. And that, in a nutshell, is locational marginal pricing.
And so when people talk about bringing it in, what are the main benefits that they might expect to see?
So I remember being in a meeting recently where somebody said, and I thought this was quite pithy, that it respects the physics of the system. So the impacts are, theoretically, that you would get less corrective action from the system operator. So one of the system operator's main concerns at the moment about the future of market design is that they're going to have to do more and more and more work, because as you get closer and closer to real time, more is known about the system in terms of what the variability of renewables are, but also because of the way investment has occurred in the system, there are places where there's too much generation and not enough demand, and too much demand and not enough generation, and therefore they have to redispatch the system to make sure that the physical boundaries, constraints on the network, the wires between the generators and the consumers, is respected. For example, I think back when I started looking at balancing mechanism stuff, we were talking about on an annual basis maybe 5% of all of the energy delivered to customers was actually instructed by the system operator, and currently today it's probably what, north of 15% maybe. And the system operator expects that kind of by the 2030s you might be looking at a quarter of all energy delivered to customers is being delivered by them, and that's because they're having to redispatch the system to take account of the market cannot internalize the constraints on the network, and they have to take action afterwards. And that is then socialised across all participants. So the main benefit that participants who are in favour of LMP is about is reducing the amount of system actions being taken on the system by the system operator, and creating a market price that's more reflective of the actual physical structure of the network.
And the upshot of all of this should be lower costs for consumers, and I suppose less wasted renewable energy and more efficient use of infrastructure.
Over the long term, yes. Yes. So there's then questions about, well, if the system doesn't change overnight when you institute the rules, then surely that cost still remains. It's just distributed among different parties. So rather than being socialised, the cost falls on the parties who are, in inverted commas, causing the problem.
Mm-hmm. So if we say that they're the main benefits, what... I suppose let's talk about other options that could achieve those same benefits. We won't dive too much into LMP itself today, but focus on what it's trying to achieve. So where should we start?
So we had a quick think, and we categorised four different approaches. The first one, access. What do we mean by access? So access is defining how a participant enters the market. So you could have restrictions on access locationally that can be used to alleviate those constraints. So the first example that we would mention would be something like Investing Connect. So this is where connection or access to the system is gated behind network investment. You cannot gain access to the market until the network has been fully developed and you have complete firm access. So firm access means you don't expect to be constrained off the system because of the technical capability of the network.
So the opposite of invest and connect would be something like connect and manage, where it's just we'll connect you sooner, but we'll do the investment later, and in the meantime we'll pay you for constraints.
Yeah. So the GB is a great example of connect and manage, because that's pretty much what happened in my example that we gave earlier, in that investing connect was taking too long, and so connect and manage was put in place, and the system operator was instructed, connect these assets, doesn't matter if you haven't done the required network investment, connect them up straight away and cope with the problem through balancing services user system charges. That would be my first example of access charging. Another example might be something called non-firm access. So this is where you could swap firmness in your connection for lower access charges, or in some cases just the ability to connect at all. So this is the kind of connect and manage process, but rather than socialize the cost, we could say to parties who are connecting to the system, you don't get 100% firmness in your connection, but you either can connect to the system or we'll charge you less for connecting to the system. So there is a kind of system like this in distribution connections where you can have non-firm access and you don't get any compensation, but there's very little guarantee in terms of what you do get. I'm aware in other markets like Australia, they actually do have a few more guarantees on it so that you won't get disconnected any more than a certain percentage of time, so you can kind of guarantee what your firmness might be. So that might be an option, as you could say to a solar farm connecting in the south of England, okay, you can connect to the system, but you're only guaranteed to get 80% of your connection guaranteed over the middle of the day, for example.
It's also something being considered at the transmission level in Britain. So they're talking about non-firm connections for storage assets, kind of to speed up the ability to connect storage. And same kind of principle would be you would only be able to access the system a certain percentage of the time.
I think when that time is a crucial part of that kind of decision making. I think parties who sign up for this kind of thing should be able to forecast the effect on their business model.
Exactly. And also, how is that information passed back to the industry? So like, is it, if I'm subject to some sort of dynamic curtailment on my site, do I have foresight of that? Can I, you know, if I'm storage, can I optimize around that and, you know that I'm going to be turned on under these hours, so instead, you know, I try export or import outside of those hours. So that's not a part of how we do those curtailments on distribution, but potentially there's something like that in future might help.
Yeah, another example here might be a tradable access. So at a certain part of the system, there is a certain amount of access. You can connect to that part of the system, but there's only ever, say, 100% of that connection available. And perhaps those who have legacy connections or paid for the firmest connections have guaranteed access to that node on the system, but they can trade it away to other parties. So, for example, a wind farm pays for the full connection asset and a complete 100% access to the system, but the wind isn't blowing today. And actually they put that access up for sale to anyone else who came across later, and they might be able to recover some of that cost. And it would mean that perhaps those who are willing to pay for complete firm access have a way of trading it back across to other parties. There's the downside here is that realistically you tend to get a correlation of generation types in one location. So if it's a windy part of the country, you've probably got a lot of other wind farms nearby. If it's not windy at your site, it's probably not windy down the road. So what is that tradable access worth? Because if it's windy, you want it. If it's not windy, it's not really worth anything anyway. So whether or not that's actually useful is another question, because, you know, storage would already kind of reduce the... Well, depending on how, I mean, it might work for storage, I guess, because it depends on whether or not the storage is full, to whether or not it can actually help with the access. But it could, for example, encourage maybe solar and wind to locate near each other, perhaps.
I think another interesting question related to access is, like, what does not having access to a market actually mean? And there's a number of different options there, right? Like, on the one hand, it could say if you don't have full access, you can't participate in this market or service. You know, that can be complete. And we've seen that. So with dynamic containment, one of the main kind of balancing services for storage, there's a condition in there is that if you are subject, you know, have a non-firm connection, that you may not be able to participate. There's a potential for exclusion from certain markets depending on how these rules are developed. There's another potential where you just kind of lose the revenue, which maybe is fair. You know, if you can't export to the wholesale market at certain times, you're going to lose the revenue to that. That's fine. But there is another kind of potential outcome whereby you could be penalized in certain markets if you don't have access. And, you know, is that a fair outcome where you've got a transmission operator or a distribution system operator curtailing an asset that it thought maybe it was going to be able to export, but then actually faces some sort of sharp penalty in a particular market?
Yeah, so I think we'd say that there has to be clarity on the firmness either way, because you can't, if there were, say, for example, an imbalance price is what you're talking about here, is you thought you would have access, you traded out the power, couldn't deliver it because after you traded, you were notified that you couldn't have traded, and then you're exposed to a price you had no control or foresight over.
Mm-hmm. Or even capacity market penalties. Is that fair that these assets would be exposed to those as well? I don't know.
So we think that covers access. The next one we were going to talk about was charging. So this is where either use of system charges that are calculated either ahead of time or ex post, so after the fact, which are there to reflect the usage of the system, but they might be temporarily distanced from actual market trading. So you may either you know them before the market trades, or you know them after and you've got to guess them, but they're not kind of done as part of the wholesale price. The intention here is that there's some sort of centrally determined method of setting a price for generating power or being connected in a congested part of the system. So the classic example of this is CNUOS. CNUOS stands for Transmission Network Use of System Charge, and it's intended as a cost-reflective value reflecting the long-run marginal cost of investing in the system. So the way that the CNUOS model for generators works is, if you connect in one part of the system, they do a power flow calculation based on incrementing generation across the demand and looking at what the marginal cost for investing for that incremental addition of generation is across the system. The more generation there is in a zone, the higher the cost of flowing that megawatt out is, because it will spread further across the system. And therefore that creates a locational signal saying that there's lots of generators in this part of the country. If you connect another one here, the price is only going to go up, and therefore there needs to be lots and lots of network capacity, which is built to service that generation, and you have to pay a large charge. CNUOS is widely considered to be not massively good at its job, but when you think about it, you're talking about it's charged on your generation capacity. It's pounds per kilowatt per year. In Scotland, you might be paying 40 plus pounds a kilowatt. In the south of England, you might get paid about 10 pounds a kilowatt. There's a really big incentive there not to connect your generator in Scotland, but stuff is still going ahead. And one of the things I think we tend to forget is that, if people keep saying CNUOS doesn't work, what does work has to be a greater than £50 a kilowatt on an annual basis ongoing cost on a generator. It's quite a big cost. So when you consider that, say, well, as for argument's sake, say an onshore wind farm might be somewhere in the region of £1,100 to £1,500 a kilowatt, adding on £50 a kilowatt per year for the entirety of its life is a very considerable part of the ongoing cost of that wind farm. And CNUOS doesn't work. It doesn't make people site wind farms in England. Well, it's almost as if.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
Something else happening.
Well, I mean, what is happening? You say there's a big incentive there. I mean, it's also, it's bloody complicated, right? The amount of modifications and changes and complexity that sits behind it makes it pretty opaque. It's hard to forecast as well. So I can't,
I would disagree with that.
But. Yeah. I mean, I think the reality is developers have a lot of other things that are driving their decisions, right? That aren't just to Nuos. And network charging is probably seen more as a cost line rather than something that's sort of driving where assets should be.
Yes, it's, I mean, ultimately, the subsidy regimes are built around megawatt hours, and therefore you want to optimize megawatt hours ahead of cost, annual cost over, you know, which gets depreciated over the lifetime of the asset and you know, gets thrown out into the long grass over the long time, and you want to get the most megawatt hours because you can compete on that. You know, the more, even if the pounds of the cost goes up, as long as you've got enough megawatt hours to cross it over, you can still compete in a megawatt hour auction. So, yes, stuff is still going to go in Scotland, even though pound per kilowatt wise, the cost of putting it in there is most expensive, and you just can't get planning permission in London for an onshore wind farm, funnily enough. So there's all sorts of reasons why Chinewas doesn't work, but those, I mean, crucially, those reasons apply to any locational charging system and any locational power, you know, pricing system.
Well, I would argue there's another kind of key problem with using Chinewas or network charging, is that it is much more of a long-term view of the system. I suppose you're not, there's no capacity, well, in Chinewas anyway, there's no scope to kind of reflect real-time system conditions and what's going on. There is a little bit of that at distribution level. We've got like time bands when the system, you know, different distribution networks that might be more or less constrained, and that kind of happens, but it's not really in a dynamic, you know, the system operator saying, hey, this wire is overloaded.
So Chinewas deals with a different problem. It's about the long run investment cost on the system. It's not going to tell you when to run your power station. It's going to tell you where to build your power station, which is part of what LNP theoretically should do over the long run, is it should inform, you know, if the cost for building for the power you receive in Scotland is lower than in England, you should build your power station in England. Theoretically, that's part of the benefit, but Chinewas does that, but it doesn't do the you should run your power station now question. So could you reform Chinewas to be more cost reflective, like you say, with the distribution charging system, so that there were time bands over which your Chinewas cost is recovered? So for example, if you could have it so that there were you could measure afterwards and say, okay, the generation in this part of the system was highest at this point, your charged based on your capacity export at the highest point of generation on the system in that location. So that would then implement some sort of system. I think maybe that would then have, there could be follow-on consequences that you'd have to spend a lot of time thinking about, because it might drive decision making that would not necessarily be optimal. And that's one of the great benefits of LNP, is that all of the decision making is kind of bundled into the one price, and so you should get a theoretically more optimal system. But Chinewas reform, perhaps making it less opaque, perhaps having more dynamicism in the way that the nodes and the zones are allocated, and perhaps introducing some time of use signals into it, could answer the long run marginal cost question. Another example that was given by Stonehaven in their challenges for implementing locational pricing in the UK paper was something called wire-by-wire pricing. So this is where, ahead of time, you would allocate a cost for each wire on the system. Ahead of trading, you would publish these prices, and then parties would know if they wanted to flow power from A to B, there would be costs associated with doing that. You'd have to run a power flow model to determine, you know, where is my power going? Which route is it using? How many of route A am I using? You know, I'm sending, if 10 megawatts down route A and 20 megawatts down route B, I'm generating 30 megawatts, and there's different costs associated with them, so that my total price would therefore be this. It does sound very complicated and feels a lot to me like LNP anyway. But that is an alternative idea. I think it would need to be fleshed out a lot more before we could properly determine how it might work in reality.
What we haven't talked about yet is connection charges, and I suppose that's another way of charging for network access.
Well, technically, Chinewas is a connection charge.
Yeah, but I suppose asset specific, when I'm a generator wanting to connect to the system, how deep or shallow are the costs that I have to pay for directly myself?
Yes, so in terms of investment, well, when you're connected to the system, there's how much of the network do you pay for when you connect? So for example, if I'm just connecting a solar farm to a substation, if I just pay for the wire between me and the network substation, that's the shallowest connection I can pay for. However, if that substation is incapable of flowing my power on further, I might then need to pay for an upgrade to either the transformer or the substation down the line, or in some extreme cases to transmission substations halfway across the country. And how much of those additional pieces of network I pay for determines how shallow or deep it is. So for example, if I then, to connect my solar farm, pay for not only the wire between me and the substation, but also the upgrades to that substation, the next substation, and the transmission substation halfway across the country, if I pay for all of that, that's the deepest connection I can pay for. And typically, you don't pay for that. It's recently changed so that it's moved to shallow across the board distribution and transmission.
I think it was technically shallower.
Shallower.
more shallow.
Yeah, more shallow. So the intention is that you don't pay for everything that's being reinforced across the network to cope with your connection, because that disincentivizes people connecting to the network. But the way that that is then paid for is over the lifetime of your asset. So you don't necessarily pay for it all up front. You then pay for it through your connection charging over time. And how much of it you pay for versus how much of it the total system pays for determines exactly how shallow or deep your connection is. That could also be, again, that's more of this long run marginal cost idea. How much are you paying for that? You would, if you wanted to disincentivize connections in some areas, you would make the connection charging deeper, make less of it spread across the life of the asset.
Yeah, and it's a balance there, isn't it, in terms of how, yeah, are you targeting costs on people directly, and is that simpler on the one hand rather than kind of doing all these complex calculations to come up with what Tinuos should be and smearing them and how they should be smeared and all that good stuff. Yeah, we've covered how do you get onto the network, how are you then charged to be on the network. I suppose there's another category or a couple of categories of alternatives to LMP as well that we've termed markets and mechanisms. So kind of two sides of it. No, they're in the same family of types of solutions. I suppose the key difference here is they look to be more carrot than they are stick. You know, with charging and access, it's kind of about, I suppose, reducing revenues. Whereas are there alternatives that would instead be trying to incentivize participation in them in return for revenue, essentially. As was the first category here, we talk about mechanisms and we think they're more about kind of one-sided products. So usually there's a single buyer. So examples might be contracts with storage assets on either side of a thermal constraint, and they can be used by a system operator to turn them up and down to resolve that constraint. In the UK, we had discussed a similar option to that, but it never went ahead, called the constraint pathfinder, where it would be, yeah, effectively central procurement of storage of some kind that would be in the control of the system operator. I do think there's a neatness to that. I mean, I suppose it's not terribly different to what we do in the balancing mechanism currently, which is the system operator, as part of a centralized mechanism, can turn assets up and down to resolve constraints. But I think the benefit is it's done on longer timeframes, in arguably a more kind of controlled manner. I think there's something about leaving, in the balancing mechanism, there's something about leaving things right to the last 90 minutes that feels maybe less than ideal. Maybe there's a benefit in having longer term certainty over how we're going to resolve constraints. The benefit of these options is they're arguably simpler than charging. I don't think charging needs to be that much more complicated, but there's sort of a neatness to a tender or a service being designed. I suppose you're still, that one of the main kind of drawbacks is that you're dependent on this central buyer and kind of optimizer to pick you and to use your asset or your service to help it out, I suppose.
And the design of the system, as we've alluded to before, is key. Is it a long-term mechanism or is it a call-off system? Because the ESO likes shorter-term products that it can decide on day ahead. It doesn't like signing up long-term deals.
Well, I debate that. I would say historically there's been, the focus has been on the shorter term. That's what they should have been doing. I think that was the, you know, the European market design, for example, around balancing is all about underpinning this role for shorter term decisions. We used to have longer term balancing services and we kind of moved away from them over time. So I don't think there's anything
There's none left. Long-term store's gone now.
Yeah, but we used to have them, which suggests that there used to be value there. And I wonder to what extent, if system operators had the kind of freedom and flexibility to procure across the timeframes that they wanted to, would they revert back to some of those longer-term products or services? Question.
I mean, it might be an institutional thing, just that that ESO for so long has insisted that it wants shorter-term mechanisms and doesn't really want to buy long-term things. Perhaps they'd have to change their thinking and think long-term, and you'd have to incorporate that into things like the network options assessment, the electricity tenure statement, the FRC, the frequency risk and control report. Because how do you, I guess, the risk that they've always, or that they have felt since switching, explaining their switch to short-term mechanisms, is that there was a risk that they were signing up for contracts that weren't good value, and that they would then get accused of being dinosaurs and costing the consumer too much money. And that feels like that's, in most of their communications, a very important objective. And of course, it is also in their price control.
I think then if we compare mechanisms to markets, so as you said, mechanisms are kind of more one-sided, single buyer, and then a market is where you can set up a marketplace. There may be, I suppose, one ultimate beneficiary behind that market, but I suppose the point is that you've got kind of clear market rules and multiple different players all competing for capacity on a given day or across a given time frame. Back to the point that you said earlier, right? The mechanism or market needs to reflect the system conditions. What was the phrase that you used again?
Respect the physics of the system.
Arguably, you know, it's the system operator or system operators that can best comment on that and advise on that. So if you don't choose LMP, the other options have quite a central role for this central party. Would you agree with that?
There has to, if we're creating a market, so ideally we want people to buy and sell things that help alleviate constraints on the system without the intervention of the system operator, because we want the system operator to do as little as possible, because we don't think that they have the same commercial knowledge or objectives that participants in the market do. So minimizing what they're doing, we want them to do as minimum as little. How do we create a market where they do as little as possible and the market does as much as possible? Well, someone still has to work out what the constraint is, and that's always going to be a forecast. So do you have something like an imbalance, a locational imbalance price, but only for constraints? Do you have something, again, a zonal system where we have a much coarser view? Instead of going down to locational marginal price, which could be hundreds or thousands of nodes or prices within the system, how about we simplify it to 6 or 7 or 27, just to pick some numbers out of the air?
I do feel like the whole debate on LMP has been kind of binary almost. Like, it's been LMP or no LMP. And zonals kind of felt like LMP's ugly cousin, right? Like, where we haven't really, it was quite quickly written off early on. I don't think it's been given enough consideration.
There's a very good question as to how many prices would there be in an LMP market? So in a, let's say we have a, I think the GB or my GB market model has maybe 3,000 nodes in it. How many prices are there? right? Because there's only actually so many constraints. There are only so many lines that are actually causing the issue. So you might find that you only have 20, 30, 50 prices because the price is the same where there is no constraint between areas. So actually, the price in, say, 100 nodes might be the same. So in that case, you have a de facto zonal market anyway. So do we actually need to go to all the bother? I mean, the main point with the zonal market is someone has to set what the zones are. So there's a role there for a body who sits in the middle and decides that you are on the, you are either in or out of zone A or B. And that feels like it might be open to, well, I guess governance has a dirty reputation for being gamed, but I haven't seen that in my time. So I feel that, well, there's going to be a bureaucratic overhead in any of these market changes. I think zonal isn't as, yeah, like you said, isn't as bad as people might think it is.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, the risk is either, there's a risk that the zones themselves become a source of investor uncertainty, or if they're not changed frequently enough, then we end up basically in the same where we are now, but just with different constraints in different areas. I suppose I don't hate it. If the other option is LNP,
There's an interesting question then on kind of longer term markets where, like, building on from your point about how the zones might change, is there a way to, is there a market where those kind of constraints can be solved in the long term? So where different network options compete against different generators, is there a solution where wires compete with batteries, compete with wind farms and solar farms, and what might that look like?
I can't even get my head around the basics of that option.
So this, I mean, it might be something as simple as the network operator identifies there's a need 5 years ahead for 2 gigawatts of headroom on boundary B6, and they hold a tender where the transmission system owner comes forward and says, we can give you that 2 gigawatts for £500 million, and a bunch of battery developers come in and say, well, actually, we could give you that 2 gigawatts for £450 million. And a bunch of the wind farm generators come in and say, well, actually, we'll build solar farms instead and give you that 2 gigawatts for £350 million. And then it would be up to a party to decide which of those options is the best. But they then have to guarantee that there was that delivery over certain time periods or something like that.
And also for a certain time period, because
yes,
wires have a longer life than a generating asset.
So I think that covers...
Well, I've got a question.
Oh, God.
I mean, like, why can't we just build more wires? And what's stopping us from having built more wires so far?
So the obvious answer to that is that it's very hard to build overhead line in GB because planning restrictions on building overhead lines, and people don't like putting up new pylons near their houses. So that's the obvious answer, that it's expensive and hard to do. But the less obvious question is, the less obvious answer is that for a long time, the objective of network planning has been about minimizing system costs, which is partly a reflection of the lesson of moving from nationalization to privatization, is that the CEGB was considered to be gold plated and had a very high cost for running the system. And then part of the objective of the privatized network was that we would lower running costs. And part of that was by optimally planning the system, not overbuilding. So where you didn't need to, you might not necessarily build quite as much network because you would rely on either smarter options of running, or you would rely on constraints, and tolerating a certain amount of constraints was considered efficient. But as we've run up over time, it's been very obvious for the last 10 years that constraints were going to continue to increase and increase and increase, and we're still staring at even more things coming down the pipe. We know that more capacity has to be connected and more power has to flow across the system, that it's not just a case of the most efficient network. We now just have to build more network, and to the extent that we're laying cables along the seabed to avoid putting them on land, even though that's much, much more expensive, but it's easier to do. So I would say that yes, it's partly because it's hard to do, partly because the network kind of planning systems are built around making sure that the network is as efficient and as lean as possible so that we're not burdening consumers with costs. Part of that has meant accepting constraints as the cost for that. But now the cost of those constraints is becoming so large that we're actually not running an efficient and lean system anymore, because if we'd invested in wires instead, we wouldn't have these constraint costs. And therefore, if you invest in an optimal system, the price differential between areas would disappear. One of the key things with LNP is how do you build in that system to know, you know, when should we build new wires? What happens when the price signal disappears because either lots of batteries have gone there or a wire has been introduced? What happens to people who made decisions in one world but then find out that the TO also made a decision at the same time and wiped out their business case?
Yeah, and is LNP almost a distraction from those decisions to build wires as well, right? Like, could you kind of cover up the need to do that fundamental infrastructure by kind of having loads of nodes and waving your hands around and having loads of prices?
And to what extent does the cost fall on in that situation? Because in an LNP market, the cost of those decisions not to invest in the system fall on the generators rather than being socialized in the current system where everyone pays. In this new world, in an LNP world, the cost has fallen onto the generators, who are now not earning as much revenue and have huge amounts of uncertainty. That's why that half of the market is less keen on LNP, whereas maybe consumers in Scotland might be quite keen, although probably once they find that the wind farms all dismantle. Well, not dismantle, but no more new ones get built.
So of the options that we've talked about changing arrangements around access, whether you should have kind of non-firm access and use that to send a signal. We talked about network charging, how that could be reformed either on the transmission level or the distribution level. We've talked about different markets and mechanisms. So can you procure services to help resolve constraints either on a long-term bilateral basis or through a kind of shorter-term market mechanism? And we've also talked about building more wires. What's your favourite option?
In a perfect world, I'd say build lots of wires and then put LNP in place.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that.
So that's my perfect option, because I think that LNP works best in was designed for big thermal systems that don't have huge amounts of constraints, and it's about optimally dispatching the system. I think it might be a good idea. I think this is a very outside chance, which is why it's my kind of fantasy pick, is that you would spend 10 years in a crash course of investing for the system of the future and investing in the new systems for an LNP market, so that in 10 years time, when your LNP market design is finally finished and you can roll it out, you've also got a less constrained system. That's my perfect answer in a perfect world that I don't think will happen.
What world are we in? I mean, I guess when we're thinking about this world as well, we need to think about timeframes, right? We've got, you know, net zero commitments. We've got targets to decarbonize the energy system. It's about what's practical within those confines as well, right?
Mm. So I think some form of access and charging signal that work together with a zonal market that's quite coarse could solve both your long run marginal where do I build a power station question, and your how best might we dispatch the market at the day ahead question, because the problem is quite coarse. You don't need huge amounts of nodes to fix the problem, and we could mitigate it to some extent through the design of other parts of the system, like the access or charging arrangements.
Yeah, I think network charging reform is important and hopefully inevitable, and it needs to be better aligned across distribution and transmission, and it needs to send clearer signals. I think the bit that I would add on to that to resolve the kind of more operational time frame constraints would be a day ahead market, So Day Ahead Market.
Four constraints
specifically. So similar to what we have that's just started running in Britain, the local constraint market, where you've got, it's targeted at smaller assets, but Day Ahead, you've got effectively a marketplace where they can bid in to provide that flexibility. And I think ideally we could do more in those time frames before getting to kind of real-time balancing time frames. So you're sterilizing certain assets that may exacerbate a constraint early on, and hopefully, yeah, leaving less to the balancing mechanism timeframes. So do you want to be in charge of reforming network charges, and then I'll do the constraint market bit?
Sure. Yeah.
That's a good division.
Hit me up off, Jim. Yeah, so hopefully that has enlightened you and me and Emma a bit about LMP and what the alternatives might be. We hope you enjoyed us being back. We very much appreciated everyone asking where we were and giving us nice feedback. Thank you very much. If you want to hear more from us, you can follow me on the website I'm always going to call Twitter, at Notional Grid, and the podcast's handle is at Substation Pod.
I am Energy_Burns on the website formerly known as Twitter.
We plan to return relatively soonish. We might be talking about things like interest rates and their effects on the power market, like cost of capital and auctions and stuff. We'd like to talk about connections, the tech amnesty, that's pretty cool. There's all sorts of stuff about negative emissions that we've got on our horizon, and I think we'd like to talk about renewable subsidies as well, because that's cool, and I don't think we've talked about it before. Bye.